The boy, who then will be a young man, will have to work this out for himself. He will fly through the air by some means. Our pictures show something like the kites with which we are familiar, but this particular kite is not tethered to the ground by rope. Instead, it appears to be controlled by those who ride on it. Muttering and urgent whispering from the congregation. This was wonders piled on wonders. Never before had such things been spoken of. For a moment there was the uneasy shuffling of feet, and then the astrologer took another drink and turned back to the, by now, diminishing sheets of paper. He shall have immense suffering, immense hardship. He shall enter a war against evil forces. He shall for some years be confined and undergo suffering such as few have undergone, the purpose of which will be to purify and to drive away the dross of any sensuality, and to build the power of the brain to endure. Later he shall get away from his captors after some immense explosion which throws a whole country, or a whole world, maybe, into confusion. He shall travel by means which we cannot identify across a vast continent. And at the end of that travel he shall again be incarcerated unjustly. Suffering will come upon him there with at least as great measure as it did in the other confinement. At last, by the intervention of unknown people, he shall be released and forced out of that great continent. He shall wander into many countries, meeting many people, seeing many cultures, learning many things. And then at last he shall go to a country where once again he shall not be welcomed because of his difference. The suffering will have changed him enormously so that he no longer seems of our own kind, but different. And when humans meet anything which is different they fear that thing, and that which they fear they hate and try to destroy. The old man was looking tired. At last the senior attendant stepped forward, muttered to the astrologer, and then said, "We will have a few minutes rest while our chief astrologer recuperates for the second half of this reading. Let us, then, for the moment concentrate upon that which has been said so that we may the more easily assimilate that which is to follow." The chief astrologer sat down, refreshments were brought to him, and he watched the throngs of people. And as he sat watching the throngs of people he thought of his boyhood. He thought of the times he had climbed the high mountains in the deepest of the night so he could gaze upon the stars arrayed in the heavens above. He had pondered long upon the significance of those stars. Did they have influence on people? He decided to find out. By various means, and probably because he was fated to do so, he entered the lamasery of the state oracle and he was found to have quite abnormal ability at astrology, an astrology, of course, which is far superior to that of the Western world, far more complete and far, far more accurate. It includes more variables and could be projected at greater depth. The young man who was destined to be the chief astrologer of the whole of Tibet progressed rapidly, studying, studying, studying. He obtained the ancient texts of India, the texts of China, and almost rewrote the science of astrology in Tibet. As his skill rose, his fame increased so that he was called upon by the heads of all the great houses of Lhasa, and then of other cities of Tibet. Soon he was called upon to do predictions for the government and for the great 13th himself. Always he was strictly honest. If he did not know, he said he did not know. He had predicted the British invasion. He had predicted the departure of the great 13th to another country, and his safe return, and he had made the prediction that there would be no real Dalai Lama after the 13th had gone to the state of transition. There would be another, but he would have been selected as a matter of political expediency in an attempt to assuage the territorial ambitions of the Chinese. He had made the prediction that in 60 years, or so, there would be the end of Tibet as it was then known. A completely fresh order would come into force which would cause extreme hardship and suffering, but might, if it were handled correctly, have the effect of sweeping away an outmoded system and bringing, after 100 years or so, benefits to Tibet. The chief astrologer sipped his buttered tea and looked at the people before him. He watched the way some of the young men looked at the young women, and the way in which the young women glanced back, coyly, invitingly. He thought of his long years as a celibate monk, nearly 80 years, he thought, and he hardly knew in which way a woman differed from a man. His knowledge was of the stars, of the influence of the stars, and of men and women as they were affected by the stars. He looked at comely young women and wondered if it really was right for monks to be celibate. Surely, he thought, mankind should consist of two parts, the male and the female principle, and unless the two parts are united there cannot be a complete man. He thought of all the tales he had heard of how women were becoming more and more arrogant, more trying to rule. He looked about at some of the older women with their harsh faces, and he noted their domineering attitude. And then he thought, well, perhaps it is that the time is not yet right for man and woman to be united to form one whole, to form one complete entity. But that will come, although not until the end of this round of existence. So thinking, he gave up his cup to an attendant, and signaled that he was ready to continue. A hush again fell upon the assembly, people were looking up toward the dais. As the old man was assisted to his feet, the books were again placed before him. He looked around once more, and said, some of the experiences which will befall the subject of this reading are so far beyond our own experience that they cannot be predicted in a sufficiently accurate form to be worthwhile. It is known definitely that this person has a great, great task to do. It is a task which is of the utmost importance to the whole of humanity, not of Tibet alone. It is known that there are evil forces, very evil forces indeed, who are working hard to negate that which he must do. He will encounter hatred, he will encounter every form of hardship and suffering, and he will know what it is to be at the point of death and have to undergo the ordeal of transmigration into another body so that the work may go forward. But here in this other body, fresh problems will arise. He will be disowned by his own people because of that political expediency which I have already mentioned. It will be considered to the benefit of the people as a whole that he be disowned, that he be not supported by those who should support him, by those who could support him, and I say again that these are probabilities because it is quite possible for our own people to support him and give him an opportunity to speak before the nations of the world so that, first, Tibet may be saved, and secondly, that great task whose exact nature may not be mentioned may be the more speedily accomplished. But weak people in temporary abridged authority shall not be strong enough to assist him, and so he shall battle alone against the forces of evil, and against the uncaring people whom he is trying to help. The old man looked around and motioned to the left-hand attendant to remove the next sheet. The attendant blushed a little at having to be reminded, and speedily did as he was bade. The astrologer went on, there is a special association or group which gives information to peoples of the world beyond our confines. They are of insufficient spiritual stature to understand the task which has to be accomplished, and their sensational hatred shall make the task immeasurably more difficult. As well as this, there is a small group of people who will be filled with burning hatred and will do everything possible to ruin the subject of this horoscope and cause him every distress. The old man paused and put his hand on the topmost sheet as a signal that he had finished with the books. Then he turned and addressed the congregation, with the years of my experience I say to you this, no matter how great the struggle, no matter how severe the suffering, the task is worthwhile. The only battle that matters is the final battle. It does not matter who wins or who loses, the wars that continue until the final battle. And in the end the final battle shall be won by the powers of good, and that which has to be done shall be done. He bowed three times to the people, and then turned and bowed three times to the Lord and Lady Rampa. Then he sat down to rest his legs, which were shaking with the weight of years. The audience, whispering among themselves, quickly dispersed and went into the gardens in search of entertainment, and there was much entertainment offered: music, acrobats, jugglers, and, of course, food and drink. After the astrologer and his two collaborators had rested a while, they rose and went into the great house where they had more to say to the parents of Lobsang Rampa. They had more to say to Lobsang as well, to say privately, alone with him. Soon the chief astrologer departed on his way back to the Potala, and his two collaborators departed on their journey to the Lamasery of the state oracle. The day wore on. There came the dusk. And at the warning of dusk the assembled people wended their way out of the great gate and along the roads so they may reach their own homes before night and the perils thereof came upon them. The darkness fell, and out in the road beyond the great gate a lonely little boy stood looking down the road at the last of the departing guests and the carousing which they were making. He stood with hands clasped, thinking of a life of misery which had been predicted, thinking of the horrors of war which he did not understand, thinking of the insensate persecution yet to come. He stood there alone, alone in all the world, and no one had such a problem. He stood there and the night grew darker, and no one came to seek him and to lead him back. At last, as the moon was full above, he lay down by the side of the road. The gate was shut anyhow, and in minutes there came a purring beside his head and a great big cat lay down beside him. The boy put his arms around the cat purred louder. Soon the boy drifted off to a troubled sleep, but the cat was alert, watching, guarding. So ends the first book. The book of Isid was in the beginning. Book to the first era. Chapter 4. O Lobsang, Lobsang, quoth mother, her face pale with anger. You have brought us absolute disgrace. I am ashamed of you. Your father is ashamed of you. He is so angry with you that he has gone to the office and will be there all day. That has upset all my engagements, and it's all you, Lobsang. So saying, she turned abruptly and hurried off as if she couldn't bear to look at me any longer. Ashamed of me? Why should she be ashamed of me? I didn't want to be a monk. I didn't want all the horrible things predicted for me. Anyone with a grain of sense would know that. The predictions of yesterday had filled me with horror. It had been like the ice devils trailing their fingers up and down my spine. So she was ashamed of me, was she? Old Sue hove into sight almost like a moving mountain. He was so large. He looked at me and said, "Well, young man, you're going to have a rough life, aren't you? I think you'll make it. If you could not have stood all the strains and temptations, you would not have been chosen for such a task. The craftsman chooses his tools according to the task to be done. Perhaps, who knows? The craftsman who chose you to be his instrument may have chosen better than he knew." I looked at old Sue somewhat cheered, but only somewhat, and then I said, "But, Sue, how have I disgraced mother? How have I disgraced father? I haven't done anything. I didn't want to become a monk. I just don't understand what they mean. Everyone today seems to be full of hate for me. My sister won't speak to me, my mother reviles me, and my father won't even stay in the house with me, and I don't know why." Old Su painfully lowered himself to sit cross-legged on the floor. His wounds inflicted by the British were sorely troubling him. He had had damage to a hip bone, and now, well, he had pain all the time. But he sat on the floor and talked to me. "Your mother," he said, "is a woman of great social ambition. She thought that as a son of a prince of Tibet, later to be a prince in your own right, you would have gone to a big city in India, and though you would have learned much of the affairs of the world, your mother thought that you would be a social asset to her. She thought that if you went to India and perhaps to other countries, then she also could have gone on visits, and that for years, even before your birth, has been her all-consuming ambition. Now you have been chosen for a special task, but that's not what she wanted. It's not what your father wanted. They wanted a shining figure in the political arena, a socialite, not a monk who is going to have to struggle all his life, not a man who would wander the face of the earth like a pariah, shunned by his fellows for telling the truth, ostracized by those around him because he was trying to do a task at which others have failed." Old Sue snorted loudly. All this seemed too utterly strange for belief. Why should I be penalized, victimized, for something I hadn't done and something I didn't want to do? All I wanted was to hang around the banks of the river and watch the ferrymen with their skin boats pulling their way across the waters. All I wanted was to practice with my stilts and to fly my kites. But now, well, I just did not know what to make of things. I did not know why it had to be me. The days sped all too quickly, and at last, as foretold, I had to leave my home and go up the hill to the Chakpori Lamasery. There I had to undergo the ordeal of waiting, waiting outside the cynosure of all eyes. Small boys clustered around me as I sat cross-legged in the dust outside the great gates. The days were unendurably long, but I endured. The nights were unbearably tedious, but I bore them until at last that ordeal ended. I was admitted to the Lamaserie as the lowest of the low, a new boy, one who was fair game, and one who was there to be picked on, who could have any manner of joke played upon him. The lowest of the low. Time crawled, and I was homesick. I missed my home, I missed Sue, I missed my sister Yasodhara, for the mother who now had no love for me. Well, I had strange sensations about her. Frankly, I missed her. Even more frankly, I felt guilty. How had I failed? Why were they so disappointed with me? How could I help that an astrologer had said I should go and suffer this and endure that? It wasn't my choice, no one in their right senses, I thought, would pick such a load of trouble as that which had been allocated to me. I thought of my father the last time I saw him before leaving home. He looked at me frozen-faced. He spoke to me harshly as if I were a stranger now, no longer with a home of my own, and no longer with parents of my own. He treated me more severely than he would have treated a convict who came to the door begging for food. He told me that I had disgraced the family by having such a karma that I had to be a monk, a lama, a wanderer, who would be mocked, sneered at and disbelieved. Yasodhara, well, I just didn't know what to make of her attitude. She changed. We used to play together like any normal brother and sister, we used to get on passably well, just, in fact, like normal brothers and sisters do get on passably well. But now she gave me such strange glances as if I were a stray dog that had crept into the house and left an unwanted gift in some corner. The servants no longer showed me respect, the respect due to the heir of the Lalu estates. To them I was just something which was lodged there for a few days until the seventh birth date should come. Then on the seventh birth date I would wander off alone without a word of goodbye from anyone, up the long and lonely path leading toward a career which I would not have wished upon my worst enemies. At Chakpori there was the constant reek of drying herbs, the constant swish of herbal tea. Here much time was devoted to the herbalist code, and less time to religious disciplines. But we had very good tutors, all of them elderly men, some in fact had even been as far away as India. I remember one elderly monk, or I should say lama, who was giving us a lecture, and then he got on to the subject of transmigration. In the days of long ago, he said, in fact long before recorded history began, giants walked upon the earth. They were the gardeners of the earth, those who came here to supervise the development of life on this planet, because we are not the first round of existence here, you know, but like gardeners clearing a plot of land, all life had been removed and then we, the human race, had been left here to make our own way, to make our own development. He stopped and looked around to see if his pupils were at all interested in the subject which he was propounding. To his gratified astonishment he found that people were indeed deeply interested in his remarks. The race of giants, he went on, were not very suitable for life on earth, and so by magical means the race of giants shrank until they were the same size as humans, thus they were able to mingle with humans without being recognized as the gardeners. But it was often necessary for a different senior gardener to come and carry out special tasks. It took too long to have a boy born to a woman and then wait out the years of his babyhood and childhood and teenage. So the science of the gardeners of the earth had a different system. They grew certain bodies and made sure that those bodies would be compatible with the spirit who would later inhabit them. A boy sitting in the front suddenly spoke up, "How could a spirit inhabit another person?" The Lama teacher smiled upon him and said, "I was just about to tell you. But the gardeners of the earth permitted certain men and women to mate so that a child was born to each, and the growth of that child would be most carefully supervised throughout, perhaps, the first 15 or 20 or 30 years of life. Then there would come a time when a highly placed gardener would need to come to earth within a matter of hours, so helpers would place the trained body into a trance, into stasis, or, if you like, into a state of suspended animation. Helpers in the astral world would come to the living body together with the entity who wanted to go to earth. With their special knowledge they could detach the silver cord and connect in its place the silver cord of the entity who was the gardener of the earth coming to the earth. The host will then become the vehicle of the gardener of the earth, and the astral body of the host would go away to the astral world just as he would do in the case of a person who had died. This is called transmigration, the migration of one entity into the body of another. The body taken over is known as the host, and it has been known throughout history. It was practiced extensively in Egypt, and it gave rise to what is known as embalming, because in those days in Egypt there were quite a number of bodies kept in a state of suspended animation. They were living but unmoving. They were ready for occupancy by higher entities, just as we keep ponies waiting for a monk or lama to mount the animal and ride off somewhere. "Oh my!" exclaimed one boy. "I expect friends of the host were mightily surprised when the body awakened and the one they had thought of as their friend in the past was possessed of all knowledge. My! I wouldn't like to be a host. It must be a terrible feeling to have someone else takes over one's body." The teacher laughed and said, "It would certainly be a unique experience. People still do it. Bodies are still prepared, specially raised so that if the need arises, a different entity can take over a fresh body if it becomes necessary for the good of the world as a whole." For days after the boys had discussed it, and in the way of boys, some of them pretended that they were going to be taking over bodies. But to me, thinking back on that dread prediction, it was no joke. It wasn't amusing to me. It was an ordeal to even think about it. It was a continual shock to my system, so great a shock that at times I thought I would go insane. One tutor in particular was intrigued by my love of cats and the cat's obvious love for me. The tutor knew full well that cats and I conversed telepathically. One day after school hours, he was in a very good mood indeed, and he saw me lying on the ground with four or five of our temple cats sitting on me. He laughed at the sight and bade me accompany him to his room, which I did with some apprehension, because in those days a summons to a lama's quarters usually meant a reprimand for something done or not done, or extra tasks to be accomplished. So I followed him at a respectful distance, and once in his rooms he told me to sit down while he talked to me about cats. "Cats," he said, "are now small creatures, and they cannot speak in the human tongue but only by telepathy. Many, many years ago, before this particular round of existence, cats populated the earth. They were bigger, they were almost as big as our ponies, they talked to each other, they could do things with their forepaws, which then they called hands. They engaged in horticulture and they were largely vegetarian cats. They lived among the trees and their houses were in the great trees. Some of the trees were very different from those we now know upon the earth, some of them, in fact, had great hollows in them like caves, and in those hollows, or caves, the cats made their homes. They were warm, they were protected by the living entity of the tree, and altogether they were a very congenial community. But one cannot have perfection with any species, because unless there is some competition, unless there is some dissatisfaction to spur one on, then the creature having such euphoria degenerates." He smiled at the cats who had followed me and who were now sitting around me, and then he went on, "Such happened to our brothers and sisters' cat. They were too happy, too contented, they had nothing to spur their ambition, nothing to drive them on to greater heights. They had no thought except that they were happy. They were like those poor people we saw recently who were bereft of sanity. They were content just to lie beneath the trees and let the affairs of the day take care of themselves. They were static, and so being static they were a failure. As such the gardeners of the earth rooted them out as though they were weeds, and the earth was allowed to lie fallow for a time. And in the course of time the earth had reached such a stage of ripeness that again it could be restocked with a different type of entity. But the cats, well, their fault had been that they had done nothing, neither good nor bad. They had existed and that alone existed. And so they were sent down again as small creatures like those we see here. They were sent to learn a lesson, they were sent with the inner knowledge that they had once been a dominant species, so they were reserved, very careful to whom they gave their friendship. They were sent to do a task, the task of watching humans and reporting the progress or the failures of humans, so that when the next round came much information would have been provided by cats. Cats can go anywhere, they can see anything, they can hear anything, and, not being able to tell a lie, they would record everything precisely as it occurred. I know that I was quite frightened for the time being. I wondered what the cats were reporting about me. But then one old Tom, a champion of many a fight, gave a rrrr and jumped on my shoulders and butted his head against mine, so I knew everything was all right and they would not report me to badly. Sometime after I lay upon my face on my blanket on the floor of the infirmary because I had been very badly burned at the top of my left leg, the scars are with me yet, and the dysfunction occasioned by the burn is one from which I still suffer. I was lying upon my face because I couldn't lie upon my back, and a well-loved lama entered and said, "Later, Lobsang, when you are healed and mobile I am going to take you to a certain peak in the mountains. I have there something to show you because, you know, the earth has undergone many changes, the earth has changed, the seas have altered, the mountains have grown. I am going to show you things which not more than 10 people in the whole of Tibet have seen during the past 100 years. So hurry up and get better, hurry up and heal, you have something of interest before you." It was some months later when my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, who meant so much to me and who was more than mother and father and brother to me, led me along a path. He went a few feet ahead on a strong horse, and I rode behind him on a pony that was as wary of me as I was of him. He recognized me as a bad rider and I recognized him as a horse who recognized a bad rider. We had what in later years I would have called armed neutrality, a sort of, well, if you don't do anything I won't either, we've got to live together somehow. But we rode on. And at long last my guide stopped. I leaned over and slithered sideways off the pony. The trail ropes were dropped and the horse and pony would not then wander away, they were too well trained. My guide lit a fire, and we sat down to a very sparse supper. There was desultory talk for a time about the wonders of the heavens spread out above us. We were in the shadow of the mountains and strong purple patches of darkness were sweeping across the valley of Lhasa as the sun sank down beyond the western range. At last all was dark except for the faint twinkling butter lamps from a myriad of houses and lamasaries, and except for the glory of the heavens above which sent forth their faint twinkling speckles of light. At last my guide said, "Now we must go to sleep, Lobsang, there are no temple services tonight to disturb you, no temple services in the morning for which you have to awaken. Sleep well for on the morrow we shall see things that you have never before dreamed possible." So saying, he rolled himself up in his blanket, turned on his side and went to sleep just like that. I lay for a time trying to scoop a hole in the rock because my hip bone seemed to stick out a long way, and then I turned on my face for my scars were still causing pain, and then I too eventually went to sleep. The morning dawned bright. From our altitude in the mountains it was fascinating to watch how the early morning rays of the sun seemed to shoot horizontally across the valley and illuminate the peaks on the western horizon with what appeared to be golden fingers of fire. Indeed for a time it looked as if the whole mountain range was afire. We stood and watched, and then simultaneously we turned and smiled at each other. After a light breakfast, the breakfast always seemed too light for me. We watered the horses at a small mountain stream, and then, providing them with ample forage which, of course, we had brought with us, we tied them together with about 30 feet space between them. They had plenty of room in which to roam and graze off the sparse grass. The Lama Minya Dondup led the way up the trackless mountainside. By an immense boulder which seemed set immovably into the cliff face, he turned and said, "In your travels you are going to see much which appears to be magic, Lobsang. Here is a first sample of it." Then he turned, and to my horrified amazement he wasn't there any longer. He just disappeared in front of my eyes. Then his voice came from somewhere bidding me to step forward. As I did so I found that what appeared to be a strip of moss hanging on the cliff face was, in fact, some loose lianes. I approached, and the Lama held the fronds aside for me so that I might enter. He turned and I followed him, gazing about me in awe. This seemed to be a wide, wide tunnel, and light was coming in from some source which I could not discern. I followed his receding footsteps, chiding myself for my tardiness, for, as I well realized, if I was going to be too slow I might get lost in this mountain tunnel. For a time we walked on, sometimes in pitch darkness where I had to feel with a hand lightly brushing the wall at one side. I was not bothered about pits or low-hanging rocks because my guide was very much larger than I, and if he had room, well then, there would be room for me. After some 30 minutes of walking, sometimes in a stifling dead air atmosphere, and sometimes in a bracing mountain breeze, we came to what appeared to be a lighted area. My guide stopped. I stopped, too, when I reached him and looked about me.